This is Seattle Port Commission President John Creighton reconvening the special meeting, actually the second special meeting of the day of the Seattle Port Commission of December 9th, 2008. The time is now 1:43 p.m. Joining me today are Commissioners Davis, Bryant, and Tarleton. Commissioner O'Hara will be joining us shortly. Also, we have Tei Yoshitani, Port CEO, Isabel Sephora, Deputy General Counsel of the Port of Seattle, and Commission Record Supervisor Donna Nguyen. I'd like to point out the exits in case of emergency. There are the double doors that we came in through on my left and the single door to my right. If I could ask everyone to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And for those on the audio feed, I should point out that we're meeting in Commission Chambers at Pier 69 at Port Headquarters in Seattle. We have a full agenda today, a number of important topics. We are going to, in the interest of time and public interest, move item 6A to the front of the agenda, and that's the Special Investigative Committee report. This report was done at the behest of the commission in response to the performance audit performed by the state auditor's office, which indicated that the port was susceptible to fraud in numerous areas. We wanted to get a handle on whether fraud existed, and if so, take corrective action with respect to it. Commissioners Bryant and Tarleton were members of that Special Investigative Committee, so I'd like to commend them and thank them for their role, and also Commissioner Bryant and Tarleton, are you?
We're going to present the report.
Okay. So yes, I was going to turn it over to you, but it's an unusual position for a commissioner.
Well, we're doing this as the committee.
Well, thank you.
Well, Mr. President, I thank you and all my colleagues on the commission for this opportunity to present the report of the Special Investigatory Committee. 10 months ago, when I was appointed chairman of this committee, I made three commitments to this commission. First, that this investigatory team would work for the people of King County, not for the Port of Seattle. Second, that while our investigation would follow the direction provided by this commission and by the state auditor's report, our investigation would follow the facts where they led. And third, that despite our interest in getting this investigation done quickly, that we would conduct this investigation thoroughly so that no future port commission should ever have to do this again. Today, Commissioner Tarleton and I are pleased to report that we have secured these three objectives. In short, this report, unfortunately, as has already been made public, reveals a culture that tolerated the suppression of information from the commission, the altering of contracting invoices, and at times tolerated an arrogant disregard for open government. I can also tell you, though, this report reveals a number of instances where port employees attempted to do the right thing, where they refused to sign a manipulative change order, where they spoke out against the directing of business to a particular contractor. And those people deserve our attention by providing a robust compliance program so that in the future they have a way to voice their grievances and bring problems to our attention. I can tell you that in the last week since I have, along with Commissioner Tarleton and former U.S. Attorney and Committee Counsel Mike McKay, since we released this report to the public, there have been several people who have come up to me and thanked the commission, all of us, for bringing this on ourselves and for opening up the port. I can also tell you there have been a few people who have come up and said, well, you know, they did get the runway built, however. Let me be clear that this investigation emphasizes that breaking the law or port policies is not an option. Mr. Yoshitani's response that was recently this morning unveiled demonstrates to all levels of the port, I hope, that this is a new day and that we have a zero tolerance for such behavior. I want to thank you for the opportunity to have provided you with this report along with Commissioner Talton, and I'll turn it over to Commissioner Talton for any comments.
Thank you, Commissioner Bryant, and welcome to all of you. We appreciate the fact that you're willing to be present and witness the end of one era and the beginning of another at the Port of Seattle. We promised the people of King County when we initiated this investigation in response to the state auditor's performance audit that was issued in this very room on January 8th, 2008, almost exactly 11 months ago to the day. We promised the people that we would do the right thing. And so we hired the former U.S. attorney, Mr. McKay, and his extraordinary team of competent, talented people to dig in to the background and history of this port. He did the investigation. We are delighted and actually privileged to be here with him as he presents the results of his report. And from this point forward, we are going in a different direction at the Port of Seattle. And so, Mr. McKay, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. President. And it's a privilege to be here to formally present
you our report. And Commissioner Tarleton was very kind to acknowledge the quality of our team. And I do want to just take a minute to make sure you and the public know, really, the quality of the team we brought together. No one person can do this kind of work on his or her own. First, want to acknowledge FTI. This is a group that we brought in. It's a national company, but they have a very strong office here in Seattle. They have a strong background in public construction contracts and projects. That includes the review of contracts, review of billings, and so forth. And the lead member of their team, Mr. Paul Ficca, had to be out of town, but Louis Wu is here, and I'd like him to stand and be acknowledged. Another important member of our team was John Keller. We do not conduct an internal investigation without Mr. Keller. When I was the United States Attorney, I had the privilege of working with him when he was a criminal investigator with the IRS. And he's now out in the private sector with the rest of us. And we bring him in now to help us. And he was kind of the criminal skeptical eye that was a member of our team and spent a lot of time interviewing port employees and other individuals and reviewing documents. And I'd like John to stand and be acknowledged. Finally, I'd like to tell you about Krista Bush, an attorney in our office. If there's any elegant writing in this report and precision, it's Krista Bush. And she's a former JAG attorney with the United States Army and a former assistant attorney general, and she's been in our office for several years now, and I'd like her to stand and be acknowledged. And she's standing, she's very close to me to answer any questions that I'm not capable of answering. So we have an outstanding team, but I also want to make sure you know that I take full personal responsibility for what's in this report. I've spent quite a bit of time with the commission, giving you a detailed report of this, summary of this report, and I won't do that again today. We released our report 6 days ago, and you and the public have had a chance to study it in detail, so I will not go into any detail other than to hit a couple of high points. I thought it was important that we define fraud. That definition is in the report, but I do want to remind you all that we were talking about civil fraud, not criminal fraud, where there might be personal self-dealing, such as in the cases of embezzlement or kickbacks. When we began this investigation, we promised to immediately inform the United States Attorney's Office if we discovered criminal activity. We did not find any suspected crimes to report to the United States Attorney's Office. I do want to note, though, that we briefed that office last month on our findings, and so they're fully apprised and had about a 2 or 3 week head start, advance notice of what we are presenting to you today. In our investigation, we conducted over 75 interviews. We reviewed over 250 pages of documents and searched over 300 gigabytes of electronic data, including emails. And as you know, we had a hotline, not just the port hotline, which I understand will remain in place, but my firm had a hotline that rang into our office. That phone number resulted in significant information, both from employees of the port and from individuals outside the port that helped us find several of the items that we are bringing to your attention today. You're well aware now of our findings. We had 10 findings of fraud, 4 that related to the third runway, 2 that related to Small Works roster program contracts, and 4 that related to professional service agreements. We also had a set of findings where we could not find fraud, but there was a violation of either state law or federal law or port policy, and we prepared those and invited those to your attention, and they're, of course, set forth in detail in our report. There was another issue that we found that didn't fall into any particular category, but it was a violation of the port ethics policy by former port CEO Mick Dinsmore that related to his use of a port consultant to obtain a paid internship for his daughter. We've set forth in detail our recommendations, and I know Mr. Yoshitani has begun to respond to those, and I believe we'll be articulating some of those today. But I do want to highlight one, and perhaps our most important recommendation, and that is that the port implement a robust compliance program, which has 2 elements. The first is a code of conduct, a very simple statement of rules. You should do this, you can't do this, and so forth. And that code of conduct must be fashioned for the port. And you can't just lift a code of conduct from some other entity or company. It has to be one that's really set up for the port, for the unique things that, and the good things that this port does. And the second element is the compliance part of the code. It involves training, it involves violation reporting, and it involves whistleblower protection. If a good compliance program is put in place, this will help prevent many of the problems that are addressed in the report today. As I indicate, employee training is very important, and we also reference or highlight the need for more legal department involvement in the preparation and implementation of the compliance program and in the procurement process. Finally, and quite importantly, we did recommend that the port consider taking appropriate personnel action in response to the misconduct that was highlighted in our report, and I understand that that is going to be presented to you today. I'm happy to answer any questions and participate in any other way you'd like me to. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McKay, and thank you for you and your team's dedicated public service and service particularly to the port in this investigation. I guess I have a couple questions for you. Number one, or maybe just a comment first off, and my experience, there hasn't been a compliance program out there that's ironclad, so I think your recommendations in terms of combining a more robust compliance program with employee training and employee discipline are all really critical elements to moving forward the port on these issues. I guess on a number of the instances of fraud that you found, there was no personal self-dealing, no criminal fraud that you could find, but there was, in your opinion, instances where the fraud committed, the civil fraud, could have cost the port millions of dollars?
Yes.
Okay. And then in the dirt fill contract, I guess, as we've come to call it, the second dirt fill contract, it doesn't seem like you found any sort of actual sort of smoking gun, one employee really committing fraud, but the circumstances around that memo, as I understand it, were circumstantial evidence of intent to mislead the commission.
Now, is your question relating to the prepayments or overpayment issue as it relates to that contract, or the December 2005 memorandum to the commission?
Exactly, the December 2005 memo to the commission.
Our investigation revealed that several people were involved in the preparation of that memo. We, of course, looked at the electronic data and hard copies to try to find out who made what changes to each draft. We thought that was important. We were able, either through the review of the documents or by interviewing each one of those individuals who were involved, be able to determine who made some of the changes, but we were not able to determine who made each and every one of the changes. So that's an important point to consider, particularly as it relates to discipline. The second point relates to how much each person knew at the time. Someone may be making a change to a memo thinking that it's accurate for one reason or another, when in fact he or she did not know it was accurate. Of course, that's significantly different from a situation where the person knew it was false and made the change so that it was a false representation to the commission. And there are several occasions where we do not know for a fact how much that employee knew. We, of course, interviewed each person, and sometimes that individual said, I don't remember. And that was frequently the response, and in many ways that makes sense because that occurred almost 3 years ago. That also could be an occasion where someone is saying they don't remember, but they do, but they don't want to tell us, and we could not confront them, as we were able to do on other occasions, with documents that shows that their lack of memory, or with documents that would be able to refresh their recollection.
Thank you. Yeah, the three versions of that memo, the three drafts and their various progression that you found, I find very, very concerning to me in terms of that the behavior around that memo really, it's behavior that, in my opinion, is very insidious, very disturbing. It undermines the very public institution that the port is and strives to be. To me, that is one of your most important findings, or digging that information up, because I think, the Port of Seattle, we're only as good as our staff, and maybe expectations weren't clearly set, maybe training wasn't clearly in place, but I think, we can have the best compliance program in the world, but we really have to rely on our staff and getting the correct information up, from the staff levels up to the commission level.
If I may, if the port had in place a good, solid compliance program in December of 2005, this might never have occurred, because someone probably would have picked up that this is not a full and complete report to the commission that it should be entitled to. And a good compliance program would have had a tool, a vehicle, or more than one tool or vehicle, for one or more of those employees to report that problem if they didn't feel comfortable going to their supervisor.
Commissioner Charlton?
Just as a quick follow-up on that, Mr. McKay, in the course of your investigation, did you run across any employees that conveyed to you the fact that they were uncomfortable with the circumvention of policy, the violation of the law, and felt constrained or in some way unable to communicate that information to anyone who would listen? In other words, was the absence of a compliance program the very deterrent to allowing those employees to give voice to their concerns?
Yes, there were several occasions. I'll highlight one. And happily, at the same time you're asking the question, I've asked Ms. Bush to come up and join me because she helped supervise a lot of the investigation and might have additional examples. But there was one, and I believe it's in the report, where, and this is in the area where we're talking about splitting up contracts when it's inappropriate to split up contracts. That person actively resisted the effort to split up the contract. He said it was going to cost the port money. And by the way, it's in violation of state law. And he was pressured by a supervisor to do otherwise. And if there was a hotline or an ethics officer to pick up the phone and call and say, God, I'm getting pressure from so-and-so to split up this contract, it would have been a heck of a lot easier. This person had the courage of his convictions to stand up in a room full of individuals and say, in front of his supervisor, who was sitting there, and said, I'm being pressured to do this, and I don't think it's right. And happily, the rest of the people in the room said, we agree with you. But it took a lot of courage. Someone else had the courage to stand up and say, this isn't the right thing to do. And his supervisor not only did not do the right thing, he reprimanded him, and a copy of that reprimand is in the report. Do you have anything to add, Krista? Are there any examples that you could point to?
The only thing I would add to that is to say that in our interviews, there were several individuals who told us that, yes, they knew at the time that some of this was going on, it was problematic, but they didn't know where to turn. And because the pressure was coming from the top, they didn't feel they really had any avenues to raise those concerns.
And one thing that concerns me about that memo, in addition to the progression of the various drafts and the paring back of the information in the memo, is the fact that it was distributed to a lame duck commission in December during the holiday season and put in commission inboxes as opposed to emailed out so commissioners could have it readily available. Did you find any specific intent around those issues?
We carefully explored that issue. As I recall, the two incoming commissioners were you, Mr. President, and Commissioner Hara. And we were trying to figure out if there was an effort to get this thing approved or done without opposition from the commission before the two of you took office. And we could not find evidence of that. As best as we can tell, this was an effort to get this done quickly because the work had to get going while the weather, so all the work that needs to be done, the signing of the contract and so forth and the mobilization of the trucks, so the work could be done when the weather was good in the calendar year 2006. We looked for it, but couldn't find it. Doesn't mean it wasn't there, we just couldn't find it.
Thank you. Commissioner Hara?
Maybe as a follow-up, Attorney General McKay, in terms of the, I guess, district attorney, on this.
Former, I'm.
don't, I don't. Well, I guess you still keep your title.
I don't believe Jeff Sullivan would be very happy to know you were saying that.
But in dealing with this particular issue, and you mentioned as a cultural problem in terms of dealing with compliance, that it appeared that employees felt that they had no place to go. Is that my sense? If you couldn't go to the top and get some satisfaction that you would be heard, that this action was wrong, illegal, immoral, unethical, I guess I can go down the whole list here, but in terms of making that type of appeal, was that kind of the culture that you felt that you found?
Yes.
In the port?
And it was, they didn't know where to go. And of course, a good compliance program with the important training element would eliminate that. Every employee will know where to go after that. And it's not easy and it's not cheap. But an employee needs to be reminded every year what the rules are and how you report violations of the rules when you see them. And we would recommend that that include signing a document saying, I know what the rules are and I'm going to abide by them. That's an important part of it. But there will be no problem after that. People will know.
Well,
and if they don't do it, if they don't do it, then in many ways, they're just as culpable because they saw it and didn't do anything about it.
Right. I can kind of concur with that. I guess just like when I was Seattle City Treasurer, we had everybody go through, review a new set of code of conduct and rules, and everybody signed off on that. If you sold penny one, that was immediate grounds for termination. No questions asked. They understood what the rules were. And I, quite frankly, I think it starts at the top. I think it starts initially with the commission, to make sure that the CEO fully understands that, and I think he does. And I think at least this commission has made that very pointed a matter of fact that this type of activity is not going to be tolerated. There is zero tolerance, et cetera. And so I appreciate your comment on that. And I guess part of this whole thing, even though the audit report has been out for a while, that in the continuation of our movement for reforms, that these classes have not been conducted, or individuals, even within the whole port structure, not only port employees, but also contractors, that there is also an obligation. And as you point out, a lot of this gets back to self-supporting. I think CEO Yoshitani and I had some discussion about this, just like when he was a plebe at West Point. You personally take it upon yourself to be an honest, forthright person, and you self-report. You self-report. And I think the obligation rests with the individual, and that's where it begins. And so, you know, I would hope that that message gets out. Maybe another point, and this is follow-up on Commissioner Creighton's, on the potential loss of money. Now, I know the audit report came out, and initially they said there was a significant potential damage that was done to the port in multi-millions of dollars by virtue of what's happened. Did you see that also potentially even on the civil side? Because I recognize you did not have subpoena power to go and ask a lot of questions. But in terms of the work that you did you see any damage to the port on a civil action? And any dollar amount that you might be able to pinpoint with your team of expert investigators?
If I understand your question, is there any opportunity for the port to bring a lawsuit against someone to obtain a recovery of funds?
That would be part of it, but also whether or not you saw some evidence that we could present a particular case to a series of contractors that were probably in cahoots or possibly in cahoots with port employees or the other activities within the port.
We were very excited fairly early in our investigation because we thought we found that. And you'll see in our report that there were representations to the port made by TTI that they allegedly lost money on the first contract. And you'll see in our report that they did not lose money. They made a significant amount of money, more than they expected to make. And we don't know if there's a basis for a lawsuit against TTI to recover some funds based on the second contract, based on those misrepresentations. I think it would require additional work by the port legal department or your outside counsel. Our job was not to investigate possible civil claims, but certainly invite to the port's attention possible claims that might be brought. This one needs some work before any lawsuit is filed.
Okay, because
but I do want to emphasize that that it does require some work.
Okay, the state auditor's office, you know, in their findings, kind of pointed out that there was the potential, you know, for overpayments, and I just wondered whether or not you've answered in your work, if you had to do this to look into it further, you'd need more opportunity to examine it at greater depth and greater detail.
Correct. The state audit certainly was a starting point for us, and in many ways helped lead us to some of the findings, that the fraud findings that we're presenting to you today. But our focus was fraud, not whether or not the port could obtain a recovery from somebody for inappropriate activity. And certainly if we came upon it without spending a lot of the port's money to develop it, we would have presented it to you, but we did not find it. But we do think that there are some leads that perhaps the legal department and/or their outside counsel should be pursuing.
Okay, well, I'll defer to some questions later. And
thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Davis?
You said at the outset in your presentation that you sent this material to the Department of Justice, and you also said that you couldn't pursue the possibility, maybe in some cases, of a criminal offense. The Department of Justice does pursue that. Is that true? They have this material. And if there's something they should pursue, they could pursue it because they have all of what you have looked at.
Yes, correct. And just to make it clear, if we come upon potential or possible criminal activity, we would have immediately brought this to the attention of the department, because that was our charge by Commissioners Bryant and Tarleton. And as I reported to you, we did not find that. Doesn't mean it didn't occur. We just didn't find it. But you're right, we did present to the Department of Justice approximately 3 weeks ago the essence of what we've now given you.
So they could pursue it, is the point.
My understanding is they're in the middle of an investigation. but they have not shared with me what they're doing, as well they shouldn't.
They don't share with anybody, but they could, that's my point, that they could pursue if they do find or go forward in looking at whether there is any criminal activity. That is what they do, and that's what they could do, and they have all the information you have.
They do now, yes. Or have access to it, I should say. We have tons of records that they have not looked at, but we've made it clear to them that we will provide to them anything that they want.
Thank you, Commissioner Davis. Mr. McKay, to follow up on Commissioner Davis's question, if there is no violation of federal law found, but say civil fraud found based on state law, and the law enforcement chose to prosecute that or those cases of civil fraud, that would properly be the jurisdiction of the King County prosecutor?
Well, if it's civil fraud, it's not a crime, and there won't be a prosecution. It has to be criminal fraud. And while it's much more complicated than we can give you in a one-minute presentation, the line I've tried to draw for you is that the civil fraud is what we've defined in our report to you. It becomes criminal fraud when they're self-dealing. So if there's embezzlement or kickbacks or bribes, that's what makes it criminal. And but who would do it? There's a lot of overlapping of jurisdiction. The King County prosecutor can just as easily prosecute under state law certain activity that is also a violation of federal law. And so when I was a deputy prosecutor here with King County, there were times I communicated with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and we agreed they'd handle the same kind of criminal activity that we could have handled. And when I was the United States Attorney, I had the same kind of communications with local prosecutors, whether it was Norm Mailing or someone else, and we made an agreement on how to proceed, even though either one of us could have proceeded. So there's checkerboard jurisdiction, which a lot of people spend a lot of time thinking about.
So if further investigation or further information turns up evidence of actionable civil fraud, that would properly be the port's responsibility to go basically bring a civil lawsuit on that?
Civil fraud is the port's responsibility, and the responsibility, I respectfully submit, begins with the kinds of things that you're talking about today, you know, the compliance program, discipline, and so forth. A different aspect of it is if there were damages that were sustained by the port as a result of someone's actions, then that could give rise to civil litigation that would result in some kind of recovery. We're not entirely sure what that is. There are some areas, one of which I've just highlighted, that your port counsel or outside counsel should take a closer look at.
Thank you. That's helpful. Are there any further comments or questions for Mr. McKay's team? All right. Well, seeing no further questions, Mr. Yoshitani will brief the commission on his proposed response, and then we'll go to public comment, if there is anyone signed up for public comment. I would like to note that we do have a viaduct briefing scheduled for 3:30. Hopefully we can get through this in an hour and 15 minutes, but we might have to defer further discussion if we do not.
Mr. President, could I take the opportunity to thank our two commissioners for doing this investigation, handling it for the commission. You did a fabulous job, very professional, and for hiring Mr. McKay and his group, obviously top of the line legal professionals. And I think this is such a thorough investigation that you are to be commended for the way you've handled it, the people you've dealt with, and the outcomes that we now see. So thank you, and thank you, Mr. McKay.
Thank you, Commissioner Davis. Very well said.
Okay, Mr. President and members of the commission, let me say at the onset that I'm committed, and the entire Port of Seattle is committed, to a more efficient, accountable, and transparent operation. And this agenda is critical to keeping our organization competitive, delivering jobs for our region, and building confidence with the citizens of King County. Now, a great deal has happened over this past week, and indeed the past year. And I want to thank you for allowing me to share my response to the findings and recommendations of Mr. McKay's investigative report, conducted at the direction of the Port Commission, and also, of course, with my full support. As I said last week, we began immediately implementing the recommendations of Mr. McKay's independent report, and we have certainly embraced this as an opportunity to build on our existing contracting reform efforts. Mr. McKay's report reflects a, quote, "get it done at all costs," end of quote, culture. That day is over. We have tough competitors and big projects, but we have to deliver those projects with fair and open competition. Now, it was nearly a year ago that we received a report from the performance audit done by the state auditor. And there were 51 recommendations for improvement, and we have taken all of those to heart. In fact, we have completed all but 7 of these recommendations, and the final ones are scheduled for completion by this time next year. You might be asking why it takes so long. These are the recommendations that relate to systems and programs, and quite candidly, these are the kinds of projects that we want to do very deliberately and carefully, and it'll take a little time. I believe that as we have implemented these recommendations, we have been transparent and accountable to the public, certainly accountable as possible. And I would hope that members of the public have from time to time looked at our website and kept track of the progress that we've made, that we've updated almost on a biweekly basis with completions of these recommendations. When the state auditor's report indicated our organization possessed a heightened opportunity for fraud, it was my and, of course, the Ports Commission's top priority to ascertain if fraud did indeed exist. And I want to give a great deal of credit to the Port Commission on this issue, and especially to the leadership of Commissioner Bryant and Commissioner Talton. As you all have heard, they hired former U.S. Attorney Mike McKay to independently investigate areas of potential fraud and other issues recommended by the 2007 performance audit. And this action, of course, was unanimously supported by all of our other commissioners, John Creighton, Pat Davis, and Lloyd Harra. And Mr. McKay has, as you've all witnessed, has done a great, thorough, very professional job, and I am very grateful to receive this report. As you know, the McKay investigation did find fraud, and again, to emphasize, not criminal fraud, where someone illegally enriched themselves, but civil fraud, where there were instances of port staff intentionally representing, misrepresenting information, altering invoices, and manipulating bidding processes. And separate from the fraud findings, staff actions violated port policies, and in some cases, state law. This we know. As to questions of criminal fraud and embezzlement, the Department of Justice continues their investigation, and the McKay report, along with the supporting materials, as you've already heard, has been shared with the Department of Justice. And this is consistent with my pledge and the Commission's pledge for full cooperation from the first moment the Department of Justice announced their investigation. And it is my ongoing commitment until they are completely finished. There were 8 recommendations listed by the McKay report, and although personnel actions were last on the list, I want to mention it first because I know that this is the item that is most prominent in everyone's mind. As I said a year ago, I have zero tolerance for fraud. In reviewing the report findings and deciding upon discipline, I considered it a number of things. I considered the severity of the finding, the extent of the involvement. I also considered elements of fairness. And of course, I have a higher level of expectations for managers. So organizational level was indeed a factor. And each and every manager has a responsibility to spot potential fraud and take action to stop it, no matter who is directing that fraud, including if it's the CEO. Mr. McKay sent 2 names to me that he deemed worthy of particular emphasis when I reviewed appropriate discipline for fraud. He did not make specific recommendations of the action, but rather highlighted those 2 employees who were directly involved in the majority of the actions that met the test of fraud. I immediately reviewed the associated material and then initiated action against these 2 employees. Now, at the port, as with any public agencies, employees have the right to a due process. So the employees were confronted with the findings and given 2 days to review the facts and comment before a final action was to be taken. Both employees submitted their resignation after being confronted with this information, and I have accepted their resignations. And these two individuals are Larry McFadden, who was the general manager of Port Construction Services, and also John Rothney, who was the project manager for the third runway project. As for the people associated with a commission memo outlining the contract for TTI, I have decided upon 3 additional tiers of discipline. And of course, this is the memo that a couple of the commissioners a little bit earlier on were asking questions about. The chief engineer will receive a 3-week suspension without pay due to his knowledge of the memo and was in a position to identify the misrepresentation, but did not do so, did not connect the dots. 3 senior managers have received 1-week suspension without pay for their failure to mention the contingent nature of the contract adjustment. In addition, I will be placing letters of reprimand in the personnel files of the deputy CEO, the airport director, and the general counsel because I believe that given their positions of authority and the importance of the issue, they should have been engaged in reviewing the memo and ensuring that the commission memo was accurate and clear. This disciplinary action is to acknowledge that in the chain of command, our leadership team is expected to demonstrate responsibility and knowledge of proper procedures, and quite candidly, to raise their hand when they see or know differently. You know, in the final analysis, the buck stops with the former CEO, Mr. Dinsmore. It was him who decided to accelerate the contract award process and also exerted pressure on staff to get it done. There was a great deal of pressure to keep the project advancing, but his decision to not absolutely be open and clear with the commission was, in my opinion, wrong. However, whether our employees' action was a result of a direct order by the former CEO or the culture of the port at the time, it does not excuse the fact that someone should have raised their hand and objected. Upon reviewing the other McKay fraud findings, I concluded that a specific action plan for port construction services is also warranted. Now, there are many fine people in this department, I can tell you that, I know that personally, who have worked hard in PCS, including some who did, as earlier mentioned, at times object to certain practices. Nevertheless, I believe the number of issues, including many actions which broke state law or port policy, warrant a specific response. So the port staff that handles small works contracts will be expected to attend an all-day training session on their own time on federal, state, and port contracting procedures. And this training will include a closing exam on their knowledge of these procedures. In January of 2008, we put in place a fraud policy as recommended by the state performance audit. I required all department heads to certify that all employees under their direction read the fraud policy. While the port ethics policy and many other related compliance policies has been previously read by port staff, we have made many improvements in recent months, and more are quite candidly on the way. As of January 1st, in a few weeks, I will require all employees to read and certify their understanding of all port compliance policies within 90 days after the 1st of January. They will not be eligible for their annual review and associated consideration for compensation increases unless this certification is complete. This measure is in addition to the significant regimen of training laid out in the port's performance audit action plan, much of which has already been completed. Based on Mr. McKay's finding of fraud, as well as the findings in which policies or laws were violated, but that fraud was not established, the report spells out suggested recommendations so that we can prevent these kinds of activities from happening in the future. In addition to personnel action, the McKay report made recommendations in several areas, and I want to cover those. I can say that the areas of compliance and procurement, major changes are underway in both procedures and culture, and I'll speak to culture a little bit later on. In 2008, we have reorganized from top to bottom how we fundamentally deliver capital projects, and I have brought in new talent to lead this effort. In a step beyond the auditor's recommendation, I established a central procurement development division, which is responsible for procurement compliances as well as obviously project delivery and a number of other functions. And we brought in a gentleman by the name of Ralph Graves to lead this division, who has extensive experience in areas of public procurement. And that relates to some 26 or 27 years with the Corps of Engineers, who does, as you know, that organization does a lot of work in the public procurement arena. So he's got great experience there and has impeccable credentials. The creation of the Capital Development Division changes the dynamics of how capital projects are delivered. And this is what I was trying to accomplish with this reorganization. It is no longer a get it done at any or all cost to meet the demands of the operating divisions. This new division reports directly to me and shares the same organizational level as the operating divisions, that is the airport, the seaport, and real estate. This establishes, in my opinion, a crucial check and balance between project management and all of the related compliance issues. Per the performance audit recommendation, we have established a new central procurement office and brought in there also a top-notch new leader in Nora Huey. And Nora is an attorney, in addition to being a very having a great expertise in the procurement process. She is an attorney who comes to us from King County, where she managed public works procurement. I want to speak a little bit about our internal audit function. Our internal auditors now report to the Port Commission Audit Committee and also to me. A year ago, we had three internal auditors. Now we have seven people in that group. The Commission Audit Committee is a new standing committee of the Commission, and it holds monthly public meetings and includes, at this time, not only Commissioners Hara and Tarleton, but also a member of the Citizens Committee, a citizen expert committee, and that's a gentleman by the name of Steve Miller, who has extensive experience in auditing. So as you can see, this whole Port Commission auditing committee has been very much upgraded and is a very, very robust structure. Nearly 300 key employees have received intensive training within the past few months in change orders and documentation, contracting, and construction management processes. And of course, our work is not done, and we are implementing reviews of our procurement to ensure that we are in absolute alignment with all laws. In the area of ethics, in January, we instituted a new fraud awareness policy and fraud hotline. Also, the Port Commission in February adopted a revised ethics code for commissioners, employees, as well as the ethics policy for consultants. While some of this occurred before the state performance audit, we have reviewed it again to ensure that it meets all of the performance audit recommendations. The McKay report has suggested additional changes to our ethics code and policy, which we will implement. Yesterday, I distributed to staff a revised and updated whistleblower policy. I mentioned this policy today because a recurring theme, as you heard earlier, throughout the McKay's report is a failure of staff to come forward to report problems and in other instances, staff voiced concerns but were rebuked. As we go forward, I want to be certain that our employees speak out when they see actions that concern them and feel safe about doing so and are invested in improving the organization as a result. I'd like to just briefly touch on a couple of items brought out in the report that were important in clarifying the port's position. One important finding of the state performance audit was that we had not competitively bid the program management services contract for work on the capital improvement program at the airport. And given the large amount of this money this program involved, this was absolutely not a small issue. And I am pleased that under a section titled, quote, where conclusions of the state audit were not substantiated by fact, end of quote, the McKay report finds that the contract was indeed legally bid, was fully understood by all parties to be a multi-year program, and sought commission approval at all required intervals. This supports what we have sought all along, that we did not waste money on this contract. Another key sticking point with the state performance audit was whether or not port employees signed management representation letters, and the McKay report supported the port employees' position that the original letters were overly broad. Employees, in fact, did sign the redrafted letters. Let me now mention three items that were not part of a specific recommendation from Mr. McKay, but that I believe are worth further action and certainly mentioning here. Mr. McKay noted that he believed Port Construction Services was splitting contracts to this day. I of course, was very concerned about that and immediately brought this to the attention of our Capital Development Director as well as our internal auditor. They had reported that some contracts still are in place that were split inappropriately at an earlier time, but that there have been no new decisions to split contracts since earlier this year. So I have asked that this report, because I don't want this just to come to me, I have asked that this report be sent to the Commission Audit Committee for their further review. On the topic of excessive profits on the part of some port contractors, Mr. McKay again states that these excessive profits or damages cannot be fully or easily quantified. I think the issue is worth another look, and I am going to be asking the audit committee to seek an outside legal opinion on this issue. Mr. McKay notes several contractors who did not cooperate with his investigation and lays out several areas where certain contractors may have been taking advantage of the port. I have asked our Capital Development Director to dig into the contract circumstances that were laid out by Mr. McKay and to ensure going forward that our new procedures will in fact ensure that history does not repeat itself. Second, I'm also reviewing what action with these contractors is merited and what options exist. In conclusion, I did not limit my disciplinary review to the scope laid out by Mr. McKay. If I thought that more people needed to be terminated or disciplined in any way for their actions, I would have taken that step. And if new information comes out from the Department of Justice investigation that, as you have heard, is still ongoing, or other regular audits, I will, of course, consider further disciplinary action. With this year's actions and now the essential follow-up work to complete the McKay recommendations, I want to put this chapter behind us and to keep using these lessons to become a better port for the future. I do know that we are a much stronger port. We're certainly more transparent, and we're certainly more accountable port than we were just a year ago. As an organization, we have learned some hard lessons from the past, and I'm confident that we have radically changed behavior at every level of the organization. We've done that by clarifying policies, by implementing training, by the reorganization that I've mentioned, and constantly emphasizing every aspect of adherence to the law. As you all know, culture changes very slowly. It doesn't happen overnight. But I feel confident that we're making progress in this as well. No question that the first step was to change the behavior. And as behavior starts to move forward in the direction that we wanted, culture will follow. This is a great team that we have. They work hard every day to deliver for the people of King County. And the nearly 200,000 jobs that depend on port-related activity. Now, we, as a region, as a nation, and indeed as a globe, face the most challenging economic times in our generation. Our place is to continue to do important work, day in and day out, to help keep the economic wheels turning in the Puget Sound region. I want to extend my hands out and say, let's all work together to harness these reforms and launch the port strongly into the next century of success. That concludes my comments, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Yoshitani. I'd like to first commend you for the actions that you've announced today. As you say, though, they're only a first step in an ongoing effort to improve the port. I want to make specific note that none of these instances of fraud that were discovered in the report happened under your watch, under your 22-month leadership. But that's not to say we shouldn't be eternally vigilant. And in your 22 months, both even before the performance audit, but particularly after the performance audit, you have been a steadfast advocate of implementing operational reforms at the port to make us a better public agency, and I'd like to commend you for that. And you made a point earlier today that your strength is in looking forward, not looking back, and I too hope that we can see the day soon when the Port of Seattle is looking forward, doing good things for the community, and no longer looking back. So I appreciate those comments as well. And as a board member, I commend you for your performance over the last 22 months. I respect your role as CEO over personnel matters, and I support you in your actions that you've announced today. That doesn't mean I agree with everything that you always recommend, and that's why we have a 5-member commission, not a 1-member commission. But in terms of this zero tolerance for fraud policy that we've announced, if zero tolerance for fraud doesn't mean immediate termination upon findings like this, what does it mean? And I think you don't have to answer that question right now, but I think the commission and the public would benefit from further clarity on that policy. Commissioner Bryant?
I just have a question. I know in the last several hours, probably each of us has been asked whether or not we thought Mr. Yoshitani's response was adequate. And if I might impose one more time on the committee's counsel, I'd like to get Mr. McKay's opinion on whether or not what the port is doing, as has been outlined by Mr. Yoshitani, is an appropriate response to the committee's report.
Thank you, Commissioner Bryant. I should report to the commission that I have been communicating with Mr. Yoshitani on this subject for several weeks. As he indicated, we did invite to his attention two particular employees, and we did that, I think, on November 14th to give him advance notice and the time necessary to properly respond. And in this intervening period of time, I've talked to him on numerous occasions, and I do want to remind you what Mr. Yoshitani said. We did not make a recommendation as to what he should do, only that he consider personnel actions. But now that you are asking me whether or not I agree with his response, I want to let you know that I do. In my view, he has considered these matters thoughtfully and has adopted a measured and proportional response that is tailored to the individual misconduct of each employee.
I support these personnel decisions, and I believe they're appropriate given the unique circumstances of the case. Do want to remind you of the three important elements of punishment, discipline. One, that it be punishment. Two, that it serve as deterrence, not just for that employee, but other employees, to make sure they don't do the same thing. And finally, that it be fair. And I believe that all three of these elements have been met when you look at the 9 disciplinary actions made by Mr. Yoshitani. There's more than one way to do it right, and you or I may have done it differently, and that would have been correct as well, but certainly what he has done, I believe, is an appropriate proportional response to the facts that we presented to him and to you.
Further comments or questions? All right. Well, seeing none, we do have a motion before us, but I think we should read the motion into the record first and then go to public comment. Who would like to?
I'll read it if you want.
Commissioner Tarleton?
Yeah. Let me read the motion into the record completely, and so it's there. And this is a motion dated December 9, 2008. Statement in support of the motion. Pursuant to the motion of the Port of Seattle Commission, on January 22, 2008, the Commission established a special investigative committee and named Commissioners Bill Bryant and Gail Tarleton as members of the committee. The investigative committee retained the law firm of McKay Chadwell, PLLC, as outside legal counsel to the committee. McKay released the report to the commission on December 3rd, 2008, which details findings, among other things, 10 instances of fraud committed by employees of the Port of Seattle. The commission, as a countywide elected oversight board for the port, is responsible for ensuring that the port's operations are conducted in a transparent and accountable manner that both promote public trust and is in accordance with the federal, state, and local laws. The commission is thereby determined that the port take the strongest possible disciplinary action against any person identified as having committed fraud or engaged in other activity contrary to federal, state, or local law, or the port's code of ethics, or otherwise violated the public trust, or did not fully cooperate with the investigation. And two, the port aggressively seeks to recover public funds lost as a result of illegal activity identified in the investigative report. The commission reaffirms the port's zero tolerance policy should any employee in the course of their duties knowingly provide false, misleading, or incomplete information to the commission. The motion reads, the Port of Seattle Commission, one, endorses all recommendations contained in the investigative report and directs the chief executive officer to implement them immediately. Progress reports shall be presented to the commission in public session every 2 weeks. The Port of Commission hereby directs the port staff to, one, continue to cooperate with the U.S. Department of Justice on its ongoing federal investigation, and to consult in cooperation with the Washington State Attorney General's Office and the King County Prosecutor's Office regarding the possibility of legal action against the former employees and or contractors of the port identified in the investigative report as having committed or and or benefited from fraud or other actions contrary to state law with respect to the port's projects in order to recover for damages sustained by the port as a result of such actions. And two, research and recommend to the commission as expeditiously as possible what measures the port shall take against contractors and other third parties identified in the investigative report, which were a party to the fraudulent activity at the port, or b, refuses to cooperate as required by the audit clause in their contracts. The Port of Seattle Commission hereby directs the internal auditor to prepare a 2009 work program to audit all currently active contracts and leases involving the firms named in the investigative report that did not cooperate or only cooperated partially with the investigation and report to the audit committee with the findings regarding their performance and compliance with laws and policies. Hereby, that's the motion, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
I should also add that all the commission had an opportunity to look at this. I especially appreciate Commissioner Tarleton's input, Commissioner Creighton's, and Commissioner Bryant's, and Commissioner Davis, to have a chance to read and look over the motion. And especially to our staff, Mary Jean Kennedy and Tom Bernard.
Thank you. Is there any comment or question on this motion before we go to public comments? Okay. With that, we have at least signed up two members of the public for comment. First, we have Mr. Chris Gower. Mr. Gower. Welcome. And if you could please state your full name, city of residence, and organization if you represent one for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Gower, and I'm a resident of Olympia, Washington. I'm representing myself. And I have a question. How did the Port of Seattle build the SeaTac third runway? Allegedly, they lied, they cheated, and they committed fraud. I have long suspected that the port could not build the third runway without breaking the law. Today, my suspicions are closer to being confirmed. I have a favorite quote. A man who lies merely hides the truth, but the man who tells half lies has forgotten where he's put it. The port has told so many lies and half lies in building the third runway, it's no wonder it can't distinguish fact from fiction or right from wrong. The unanswered question today is, why did these individuals allegedly commit fraud? That is a mystery best solved by the U.S. Department of Justice. Mr. John Keller, an investigator working for Mr. McKay, tried to contact me through an intermediary. I declined to speak to him because I did not know how the Port of Seattle would twist or bend or otherwise use my statements. I did not know if my information would be used to protect and defend the Port of Seattle in possible criminal proceedings. I have another question, and this is rhetorical for the board. Did the Port of Seattle share Mr. McKay's detailed findings with its criminal defense team, as well as the federal investigators? And if so, is that a conflict of interest? And what about the port commissioners, Pat Davis, Bob Edwards, Paige Miller, and Claire Nordquist? What did they know about the alleged third runway fraud, if anything? And when did they know it? The third runway was not built by a get-it-done culture. And I know that because I've been associated with the third runway fight for 10 years, which is longer than anybody up there, with the exception of Ms. Davis. The third runway was built by the Three Stooges. It took the port 16 years to build a third runway because of their own mismanagement. And at the end of the day, with careers ended and reputations ruined, was it all worth it for a pile of dirt and a slab of cement? Sadly, the Port of Seattle has cast the third runway with the indelible stain of scandal. Instead of blaming your opponents, please take full responsibility for your own mismanagement.
Thank you. Next, we have Mr. Peter Phillips. Mr. Phillips. And that does it for the folks signed up for public comment for item 6A. If there's anyone who would like to make a comment, please see Jenny at the front desk there.
Thank you, Commissioners. My name is Peter Phillips, and I'm speaking today as the president of the Seattle Marine Business Coalition. The Seattle Marine Business Coalition represents about 300 small businesses, mostly, that are involved in marine industrial land use, mostly clustered at the north and south end of the viaduct in the Duwamish and the Binmic, although a minority of our members are port tenants. All of them rely on the economic engine that the port is to allow us to do our work in the maritime industry. With regards to Mr. McKay's report, I'm gratified that no criminal malfeasance was found, and I note that the malfeasance that did exist was due in large part to response to pressures from the former CEO to get it done and the corporate culture that he personified. It is evident to me in the last 22 months that culture is gone. I was a participant in the Century 21 agenda, which I found to be a transparent and collaborative process intended to get stakeholder input on the port's core mission, its social and environmental responsibilities, and I believe that 21 agenda discussion was successful.
I would urge the Port Commission to support the current CEO in his efforts to move forward with the new corporate culture, supported by strong ethical standards, to further the port's core mission of promoting commerce, especially in these tough economic times. I think we have more important things to do than to lay blame on the past. We hired, or the Port Commission hired, Teyosh Tani to lead this port because of his management style and his experience, and I urge you to let him do his job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. Next, we have Ms. Lise Kenworthy. Ms. Kenworthy.
Good afternoon. You all must be ready for an energy drink. As a resident of Magnolia, who's been involved with the maritime industry and port activities for now, my hair's graying too, 25 plus years, I want to say how noticeable the difference is since CEO Yoshitani came on board for the good. I think it is really critical that our community as a whole, that those of us who are aware and track the port with the help of the media, be aware of all the effective changes that have been made. I'm particularly conscious of those regarding the port ethics. As somebody who served years ago on the first ethics board and who specifically asked for meetings with staff and training requirements, I was very glad to see that you have implemented that recommendation and many more, many more. And I concur with Peter Phillips' remarks about the professional qualifications, but I would also like to add your personal character of humility and openness and integrity. We owe you a debt for hanging in there with us through these tough times. And to the commission, this has been a tough job, and you've really led well.
Thank you, Ms. Kenworthy. Next, we have Mr. Eddie Rye, Jr. Mr. Rye. Welcome, Mr. Ryan. If you could state your name, city of residence, and organization.
My name is Eddie Rye, Jr. I'm a resident of the city of Seattle, and I'm representing the Community Coalition for Contracts and Jobs. I've been involved in the struggle for economic justice for the African-American community and small businesses for the last 40 years in this city, and I really must take exception to some of the glowing remarks I'm hearing about not wanting to go back into history, because what we see right now that's occurring at the port and other places with this fraud, bid rigging, and collusion has been a continuation. Nothing has ever stopped. And Mr. McKay is an outstanding individual, and I read where he indicated that unless he looked at people's books, he couldn't determine if any person benefited that was a port employee for any of the work that was done on the third runway and other projects. I must remind Mr. McKay, I was involved when the grand jury investigated fraud on about 20 different federally funded projects in the state of Washington, and when they turned the findings over to U.S. Attorney McKay, it was determined that there was a conflict of interest, and this investigation was moved to Washington, D.C. It involved about 12 general contractors misusing women and minority firms, and 4 years later, two firms got slapped on the wrist. All of the small businesses and African-American firms went broke. They lost their homes and everything else. There was a press release that was sent out by the U.S. Department of Justice naming two firms and two minority firms that were used as pass-throughs. And it's really ironic, all these years later, we come back and see the same names mentioned once again. So all is not rosy. It might be rosy for some of the industry, but when times get tough, they're always tough for African-American and minority businesses. And I would like to say that I certainly hope there is a thorough criminal investigation done, because I'm not buying, I don't see where anybody benefited from what happened. you don't send that kind of money through and somebody not benefit. And the other irony in this thing is we hear all these excuses why small business and minority and women firms can't be utilized, but it seems to me that government agencies do whatever they damn well please when they want to deal with their preferred contractors. So I'm saying I really hope you do look at this. And one other thing I want to add is your chief procurement officer is all wrong, and her actions right now has nothing to do with the companies that were named for not talking or being involved with the criminal activities. But to go out and cancel all the contracts with small businesses doesn't make sense. She's doing more to hurt small businesses than to help them. And I'm talking about contracts where there is a year and two option years. Just to summarily cancel those contracts is devastating to small business. People plan, and as hard as times are in terms of getting credit, people have to go back and try to get credit again, and it won't work. You're killing small business, enforce the law, and I hope to God that the federal government through the Department of Justice come through here and met out some punishment. It's time should be over for individuals who get slapped on the wrist and fined $1 million when they're doing $300 million a year, and they stay in business and the small businesses are crushed. It's time for these firms to be debarred from doing business anywhere until they can follow the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Rye. Next we have Commissioner Claire Nordquist. Commissioner Nordquist? Okay. Thank you. With that, that concludes everyone signed up for public comment. I'll give one last chance. We have a full house. I know there's other issues on today's agenda, so we should really power through. We do have a motion read into the record. Is there any further discussion, comment, or questions on that motion? Okay. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Mr. Yoshitani? I guess we have a half hour before we have the scheduled viaduct participants coming through. So,
if I may ask the commission to indicate whether you will. Are you willing to take action on the unanimous consent calendar items 5A through F?
Okay. Where's everybody going?
Should we?
We weren't here for the live.
We do have a set of minutes to approve, though. Why don't we get out of the way? And first, the minutes for the special work session of October 21st.
No, we don't. Okay. We don't have minutes.
Okay. We don't?
They aren't ready.
They're not ready.
Okay. Well, then let's go on to the consent calendar. Are there any questions or comments on anything on the consent calendar? Do any commissioners want to pull anything off? Do we have any members of the public who wish to comment on any of the consent calendar items? We don't have anyone signed up, so.
I move the adoption of the consent calendar.
Commissioner Bryant so moves. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Okay. I want to make sure the appropriate staff members are here. Do we have the right people for the Terminal 3091 update? Okay. Well, let's see. Since, Mr. President, I assume that you want to, that we just want to keep going except for the Alaskan Way Viaduct, which would be at 3:30. So we'll just keep moving along with the other items. Is that okay with you?
And we do have two gentlemen signed up for a new business item, the ship at Pier 66.
Okay.
Since we will have a rather long meeting today, why don't we go to that item? First, we have Jeff Arnault. Mr. Arnault?
I think they left.
Is Mr. Arnault still in the audience? And David Harolds as well? Harolds? Okay. Okay. Well, then why don't we go through the rest of the briefing items?
Charlie, are we ready?
6C, can we do that?
Oh, okay. Excuse me. Mr. President, the item 6C on policy and staff briefing, this is on Terminal 3091 update. Fred Chow and Tyson Mock will provide the briefing. Guys.
Good afternoon, Commission President Creighton, Commissioners, Mr. Yoshitani. My name is Fred Chow, Project Manager on the Terminal 91 Cruise Project, and here with me today is Tyson Mock. He is a Project Manager on the Terminal 30 container portion of our project, and we'll be making today's presentation to you. For the Terminal 91 Cruise Project, as of end of November, we're approximately 80% complete with building construction. And we're pretty much on target and to have the facility fully ready for the cruise season, which will start in April of next year. And the next series of slides that we'll be sharing with you were taken about a couple of weeks ago. And the very first slide is of the main lobby area that's on the first floor as you're coming into the cruise terminal building. This is the area that you will see. And we have altogether four sets of the stairwell escalator assembly. And there are two near the front of the building and two at the back, and this is the front, which is on the north side of the building. And in the middle, you can see that there is an escalator. And then on the two sides, we have a couple of stairs. And on the very lower left, you have an elevator. And I'm happy to report one of the elevators is already functioning. And then the escalators are being tested and commissioned and should be functioning very soon. This next slide shows the progress we're making on the second level. We have fully sheetrocked or drywall the interior wall and have started taping and mudding the walls. And so if you go out there today, you'll see some painting activities taking place. And here we can see a couple of skylights. And this is a feature that we're having. And with the skylights on the second level and also in some of the main lobby areas, we'll be able to conserve energy and which is helping us to make a poor green facility or a green organization. And the next slide here is a office hallway in the Customs and Border Protection area. And we have the walls painted already here. And you can see that much of the ductwork and also above or the communication conduits and power conduits are also in place. And the contractors actually is currently installing the ceiling grid system, and next week we may be able to start installing the acoustical tile. So the CBP area is quite far along in terms of overall construction. And now moving out to the outside of the building, and here this is the west side of the building. And last month the contractor has spent a lot of time installing or finishing installing the metal siding and also the trim work and some of the exterior doors, like the ones pictured here. The roll-up doors are complete. And then this big crane here, or the pumper truck, is pumping concrete to the balcony area. And this balcony area is, this topping slab is where the cruise passenger will be spending time on before they get onto the mobile gangway onto the cruise ships. And this last slide I'd like to share with you is on the air handling units on top of the roof and some of the ductwork. And the ductwork here is showing on the second level of the cruise building. We have completed all the installation of the air handling unit and happy to report to you that the building is being heated by these air handling units. And it is really important because we have a lot of finishing work going on. We need the heat. And for especially this weekend, we're expecting temperature dipping down to the 20s. So we're moving right along and no special problems to report. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks, Fred. Good afternoon, Commissioner and Mr. Yoshitani. My name is Dixon Mark, the project manager for the T30 upgrade project. This picture showed the construction of the Crane Power Electric substation. Picture on the left showing the completion of the slab, and then a week later, as you can see, they have pretty much set the substation. Today, the cable had been pulled, and this substation will be providing power for the new cranes. This is a picture for the installation of the waterside concrete pile. The one on the left showing the piling installation, and the one on the right, close-up of how tight those piles are between utilities and such. And today they have completed all of the concrete pile driving. Went pretty well. So next slide. This is a picture showing the construction of the landside crane beam. On the landside, they have completed all the concrete pile installation as well as the sheet pile installation. This picture showing they have proceeding with the rebar placement for the landside crane beam. Finally, I can say we're closing the book on the cruise building. It's all gone now. Construction for T30 upgrade today is probably at around 55% completion. This concludes my presentation. Any question?
Thank you, Tyson. Fred, are there any comments or questions from the commission?
So I take it the new crane piles will handle the largest types of cranes on 30. Is that the reason for the upgrades?
Yes, these pretty much will handle very similar crane that's currently on Terminal 18, which are the new ZPMC crane.
Okay. Tyson, in terms of where we are at the point in this construction project, what, in your view, are the major risk factors in terms of getting the project done on time and on budget?
You know, since the beginning, there's two items that we identify as a risk item. One is the crane power, getting it on board. You know, that's one of the major risk issue. And the other would be dredging, obviously, because we have a time frame that we can dredge and complete it by. As of today, we have all the approval for dredging, and it started in December. And I believe this week they're working on the upland portion. They're going back and forth between upland disposal and open water, depending on the capacity, because we have a limit of how much we can handle for the upland disposal at one time. So you know, the dredging, I think the risk is pretty much gone away, unless we have a major snowstorm that affect the train capacity. The next risk item would be the crane power getting on board by March.
And I know in our prior project we had some issues with dredging, over dredging, mainly caused by the rough water and the rough weather we were having at the time. But I mean, the weather has been fairly benign.
Right.
At this point, hasn't it?
Right. Mainly the challenge was at Terminal 91, because that's an open water area that that really impacted the accuracy of the operation.
Okay. Thank you. Further comments or questions from the commission? Commissioner Charlton?
I just want to say keep going and hope that this weather holds up. Schedule is getting tighter and tighter.
That's correct.
Thank you. We do have someone signed up for a public comment on this item, Mr. Fred Fellman. Mr. Fellman, welcome, and if you could state your name, city of residence, and organization for the record, please, sir.
Hi, my name is Fred Fellman. I'm the Northwest Consultant for Friends of the Earth, and I live at 3004 Northwest 93rd Street in Seattle. And it's very good to see the progress that's being made, and it's hoping that we can get a little tour of that T91 facility. It looks like it's inhabitable, maybe with a hard hat or something, but it would be great to get a look inside. I would love to know what percentage of the dredging is done. I mean, are we, if that's one of the liabilities, I mean, how much further do we have to go? And with the fish window, are we looking like that's on schedule? Would be one of the things that I think would be important to know, and was a little surprised it wasn't initially part of the presentation, but it sounds like it's progressing nicely, and I'm happy to hear that. I was just concerned that there's two things that are sort of still sort of outstanding with regards to sort of the operational issues associated with 91 that are not completed yet. And I would only ask, and I've been speaking with some elected officials and tribal leaders that are similarly concerned of interest, that before we do long-term agreements with this terminal, that we have the cruise ship MOU updated, and that we have the evaluation of what we're doing with regards to sludges concluded. And then once we know what we're talking about, then we can talk about long-term agreements with the cruise lines. And I personally don't understand why we're spending $1 million of, whether it's revenue bonds or not, it's money that continues to cost the port's maritime division its inability to be profitable. And that if we're going to choose to spend that kind of money, I would appreciate it if we could just make sure that we know that we have a current MOU and that we have an understanding about what the agreed upon operations at the terminal are before we go into a 10-year agreement. But otherwise, I'm happy to see that the dredging is not causing any grief, and I'm happy to see progress is occurring.
Thank you, Mr. Fellman. Tyson, would you have information in terms of what stage are we at in the dredging process? What percentage has been done?
Yeah, I mean, due to the timing of the commission memo, and so that's why the picture wasn't included for the dredging. But they just started in December 1st, which is last week, for open water dredging. And so far, things are going along. I haven't heard any challenge at this point.
Well, thank you. I want to commend you too and the project team for really working hard to keep this project on track and on budget. And even though this facility, this cruise terminal, is relatively bare bones, as they tend to be in the industry, I think that we in Seattle by far have the best view from our cruise terminal. So I think that's a real competitive advantage for us.
Mr. President.
Commissioner Davis.
Since you mentioned it, just a footnote, nothing to be decided now, but the Art Oversight Committee is looking at this building. And unfortunately, when we passed the money through originally and they let the contracts, we did not include an art element. And some good ideas have come forward, some pretty exciting ones, actually, and probably appropriate to the building. And we're moving forward looking at things, but the stumbling block is we really haven't put in a percentage for art. And it just, you can tell by looking at sort of the bare bones look of it, it just is ripe for some wonderful welcoming things that may have to do with Alaska and kinds of art there. So just to give you a little warning that we're looking, but we're going to have to come back here. If you have suggestions, let me know. I'll pass it on to the committee. But also, the funding is a little bit problematical here for next year.
Well, definitely. Thank you, Commissioner Davis, and that's a wonderful idea if we can find the funding. And please keep us apprised on that.
We need our contingency back.
So,
thank you.
Do we have a quick item, or should we go to a quick break before, so we can get a quick break in before the 3:30?
Up to you, Mr. President. Let me just add, though, that on Terminal 30, that I just received a phone call the other day from Mr. Zhang Bing, who is the president of China Shipping, and expressing his excitement about the prospects of opening the new terminal, Terminal 30, and actually wanted to do some joint marketing with us and with SSA. And of course, I told them that we're anxious to do that. So they're starting to ramp up a little bit, and so it's kind of exciting. Can we do 7A real quick?
Sure, why don't we do 7A and then go to a quick break before the viaduct briefing?
Okay, 7A is, is an authorization for additional $350,000 to increase the current budget for existing expense projects for the continuation of contingency plan on the cranes at 246, Michael Burke and Ann Porter, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Yoshitani, commissioners. As you know, we've been dealing for some time with the gearbox failures and gearbox problems on the ZPMC cranes at Terminal 46. Last year, you approved funding to help us deal with both the immediate need to keep the cranes, get the cranes operational and keep them operational, as well as to determine the cause and a long-term solution to this problem. At this point, I can report that in terms of the short-term, keeping the cranes working and an interim solution, we've had a lot of success in the last year in being able to expedite the swapping out of gearboxes when they fail. We have now two and really even almost a third gearbox available to rapidly swap them out when and if the next failure occurs, and it's probably more when than if. On the other hand, in terms of the long-term solution, we've had less progress in that area. We're still really sorting out among a number of different possibilities. Several of the studies that were done last year were inconclusive. We're currently working with a consultant to review the past studies and see if can uncover what we think is the most probable cause and proceed ahead with trying to get the gearboxes redesigned and reinstalled in a way that they last in what should have been their long-term use, and hopefully recover the costs we've incurred over this problem. And to get a little more detail into this, I'm going to pass it over to Ann Porter now.
Thank you, Mike. The funds that we're asking for today would be used to continue our contingency plans. As Mike mentioned, we purchased spare parts and they've been placed in storage in order to be ready so that we can make very speedy repairs in case of additional gearbox failures. We'll also continue to monitor those gearboxes for vibrations and oil quality in order to better predict potential failures and to provide important data that could be very helpful in identifying the failure causes. Our schedule for this work is not known completely due to the uncertainty of future failures and the lack of, at this point, a permanent solution. But the funds approved today will allow us to continue the monthly monitoring and sampling through June of 2009. The engineering analysis that Mike mentioned is also underway, and we hope to complete that work by the end of the year. And hopefully the results of that analysis will provide us with a better idea of the cause or causes of failure so that we may proceed, if possible, with a permanent fix. Until then, we're covering ourselves until next July with the contingency plans. The results of the engineering analysis may also eventually help us return to the manufacturer with a claim for recovery of costs. It's very encouraging to note that the same manufacturer has recently reimbursed us completely for all of our costs related to another series of failures on the same cranes that we took measures that we had to at the time to repair, and we have completely recovered our costs.
Thank you. Commissioner Charlton?
What was that total amount of cost recovered?
The total amount for the port is approximately $133,000.
That's right. I remember when that came up.
The tenant's portion was about $50,000 for having to float the crane during operations when it was down.
Very good. Thank you.
Commissioner Davis?
I guess I'm misunderstanding that we repaired it and the same company from whom we bought it reimbursed us for the cost of repairs of their flawed pieces, or what, gearbox, or is this another company that reimbursed us for having repaired it?
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't give you all those details. This is ZPMC, so it's the manufacturer of the cranes, and the problems that they reimbursed us for were quite different than the gearboxes. It was a fracture of a trolley rail, completely broke. And so we had to get another crane up on top of the crane to weld it back together and put in the repair materials.
Then there were some additional cracking of welds that we repaired, and that was the extent of those repairs.
Are there other instances of gearboxes failing from this company that they were purchased? I know it's not the crane company. It's a Dutch or a German company.
Flinders.
Have they failed elsewhere, do you know?
We've not been able to find a specific case where these gearboxes have failed like they have failed with us. We at one time thought that there were some issues with the bearings at other places, the Siemens bearings that we have on here, but the latest information we got is that that's not the case. And the bearings, when Siemens tested them, that we sent back from the fourth gearbox failure that we were dealing with, those bearings did not, those tests did not show any particular irregularity in those bearings, which was somewhat disappointing as we were hoping that would help us to determine the solution.
This just keeps coming back like a bad penny. I can't figure out why it's so ephemeral, like we can't pinpoint anything. We just have to keep repairing.
Well, I think the frustration is shared on throughout the room here in this. What we really think we need to do here, and sooner than later, is to pull together the information we have and to go to ZPMC with it and say, you know, based on what we have, all the studies and all that we got, and this is partly what this current engineering analysis is that, you know, here's where we think the likely causes are. If not a specific cause, and really based on, you know, the fact that we believe, at least Dean, I'd say right now, that the most likely cause is either a design deficiency or some kind of manufacturing defect. Either case, it would be ZPMC's responsibility in our view. And so we'd go back to them and say, we need you guys to step forward and to make us whole in this area. Now, it's an international company. There's a lot of issues about crane operation and a claim against them. And so how successful we'll be in that is something I'll leave to the legal side to be talking to us about as we get more involved. But it'll be difficult to be fully successful in that.
Thank you. That was a great answer.
One of my few.
Sort of leaves me right where I am.
Very enthusiastic. Commissioner Davis. Commissioner Hara.
Mike, I know this problem's been going on well over a year, and I guess the other element is, you know, one, you had the rental of the crane, since I believe we rent to the terminal operator, which is Hanjin, and also how it impacts their operation and whether or not there are any penalties by virtue of the cranes not working. So, you know, is there additional costs that are being incurred by the cranes not being properly operating?
The cranes are operating an hourly lease rate to Total Terminals Incorporated, who is a subsidiary around 60% owned by Hanjin. Total TTI is their West Coast terminal operator.
Right.
And we've reimbursed TTI for their costs related to previous problems with these cranes when they were, you know, first occurred. As well as Ann pointed out, we've gotten some additional refunding from ZPMC over the costs they had with the weld repair. And right now, you know, the goal is that when we have another failure and we have to swap out the gearbox, that at that point we will take over the work on the crane. It'll be the port which will directly contract for swapping out the gearbox and putting in a replacement gearbox to keep them operating so that we won't incur any operational cost on TTI's part.
Okay, so I take it you figured there's kind of a bottom line here as to what it's costing the Port of Seattle. One, in deferred utilization of crane equipment, and also, you know, to them from an operational standpoint, because if the cranes aren't working and they have some cranes that are down, and you miss your port call or ability to move and move those boxes on and off the ship, you know, that's, you know, becomes a cost to them, and I assume that they'll probably ask for recovery in our port.
To date, they have not indicated that they're going to ask for any specific amount in that area. That what okay. We've reimbursed them is what they were expecting, but there's no question our tenant has been significantly impacted by this, and it's been difficult, especially when their volume grew significantly when Costco moved over there about a year and a half ago.
Okay. Well, recognizing that we may have a potential cost, I guess the other side comes back to our legal position to go back to ZPMC or to Flenders, I guess, is the gearbox maker, correct? And we talked about it this before, and apparently, you know, no action is taken at this point against either the maker of the crane or the gearbox manufacturer.
Right. We have not taken any specific action against them. We've been working under the more the premise that we wanted to get the cranes working, to work cooperatively, to, you know, to both solve the interim problem, getting them working again, and the long-term problem of what is the exact cause, rather than get into an adversarial situation immediately with the manufacturer of, no, it's your fault, and then pointing back to us and saying, no, it's not. And meanwhile, nothing gets done. So, and I would say, and I think Ann and Charlie, I know, has had a close relationship with them, that ZPMC has been very cooperative in this issue to date in working with us and specifically reimbursing us on other issues.
Yeah, Mr. President,
Commissioner
this is a lease commitment. We have to do it, and I'd like to move approval of this. I'm just frustrated with this, like the KJR radio station for 15 years kept coming back at us. So I hope you can figure this out one of these days. And you've done a good job in terms of relationships with Han Chin, so thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Davis has put forward a motion for approval of Marine Item 7A. All in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. The motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. And if we could, I'd like to call for a 5-minute recess, and then we'll come back at 3:35 to hear the viaduct briefing.